The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we speak with Mark Polonia of the Polonia Brothers on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we presented one of two interviews that birthed Third Eye Cinema. These took place on another show that I'm partners on, where they appeared in a much rougher, live-oriented format. This was actually the first interview that I sought out and scored, and we deliberately kept things general and fairly light, touching on the trials and travails of producing a truly homegrown, independent Shaman video cinema for over 25 years. For the first 12 minutes, due to some technical issues, I was unable to get into the studio, so you'll be hearing a few ad-lib questions from my partner Matt from the other show. But hang in there, things do kick into gear shortly thereafter. Be sure to stay tuned to Third Eye Cinema in the future for more from Mark. He's a great guy and a real inspiration, and we'll have some exciting news to announce at some point later in the year. But for now, enjoy a more professional re-edit of the very first unofficial Third Eye Cinema interview, making its official debut tonight right here on Third Eye Cinema.
Making a film is very difficult, even under the best conditions. And you really have to, I think, this is my opinion, of course, people can disagree with me if they want, but you really have to love what you're doing, be committed to it, and you know, you just have to see all the possibilities. I think the problem is some people get into filmmaking because they think it's going to be a way to make lots of money, meet chicks, it's going to be fun, and I guess it could be all that, but it's a lot of hard work too, especially conceiving a project, planning it, shooting it, editing it, and then trying to market it. It's a huge endeavor, even at the, you know, level that I work at, and I think people just give up. When I started in the 80s, there were scores of filmmakers that were, you know, doing the same thing, and they may have made one feature, maybe two, but then they just disappeared because they just lost the passion, or they just didn't, you know, they just didn't connect with, you know, this is a really a tough thing to do, a tough thing to accomplish, and it takes perseverance, I suppose, or stupidity, and, you know, in our case, it could be both, but...
Was you shot that on what, VHS, or was that Beta, or...
It was VHS, yeah. We shot it with my dad's camcorder. You know, all parents at that time bought camcorders, mm-hmm. thinking they were going to shoot it, and spent most of the time realizing that, you know, the camera was off when they thought it was on, and it was on when they thought it was off. So we eventually inherited this camera because my parents had no use for it anymore. So that's what we shot the movie with. And, you know, at that age, youth and naivety certainly play into it, because we didn't think we couldn't do it. It's not that we thought we could do it, it's just it never crossed our minds that we couldn't do it. And I think that helped, that and just a lifelong love of filmmaking. And, you know, we'd shot tons of Super 8 shorts and pretty elaborate things before we got to Splatter Farm, which, you know, still is lacking in a lot of different areas, but it was a start, and our intention was just like Wes Craven and Sean Cunningham, and, you know, you got to make something that's going to get you noticed. And we were 17, 18 years old when we made that, and it got domestically released all over the United States. So we kind of had a hit right out of the gate. And, you know, some of it was luck. And I'm not going to say it's a, because it's such a great film, everyone needed to see it. But right time, right film, right place, that was the start of it right there. Had that movie been not gotten released or been a failure, we still would have, you know, kept going. But the older you get, the more daunting the task becomes. So it's probably a good thing we had that success early on, because that was always a goal. You know, you got to set levels. Yeah, I want to make a film that's going to get distributed on VHS. Okay, we did that. We wanted to make a film that got on cable television. We did that. Even though it was Canada, it was still cable television. So, you know, you set goals, and eventually, if you don't look back and you keep looking forward, you realize you've accomplished something. And I think that's an important thing, too, is it's one thing to go, oh, yeah, we made a film that's on VHS all over the United States. Well, you know, big deal. So do a lot of people. You never stop to look at where you're at or where you've been, because then you grind to a halt. You just have to keep looking forward and moving on to the next production and hopefully making it better. And then after time, you do stop and look back very quickly, and you realize, wow, you know, something did get accomplished here. And I think those are some of the factors that have helped us, you know, in the longevity of this business, because by God, it's not very long if you look at most people's track records.
Sure, and the fact that almost, 30 years later, you're still making films, it's to your credit. Absolutely.
Sure. You know, if you professionally look back, it would have been 87. So.
Something you had said earlier where you said that you didn't know that you couldn't do it, it actually reminds me of something that I remember hearing a motivational speaker talk about a while ago, intelligent ignorance. Basically, don't know that you don't know something so that you're not limited by any, preconceived notions or anything. So.
Right. He's right, because, you know, you're your own worst enemy, and you know, people who fail at things can blame a lot of other people and a lot of other reasons, but you have to really start with yourself. I mean, I'll be the first one to admit, you know, some of our movies are not that good. I mean, that's just a fact. If you watched every one of them, and I hope you haven't, you'll see that, but that's the way it goes. You know, you can't be afraid to fail. You can't be afraid to not try. You can't be afraid to let the masses see it and then rip you apart on the internet. That's just the way life goes. They're going to do that with Among Us or Muckman as much as they're going to do it with The Phantom Menace and Revenge of the Jedi. I mean, that's just the way people are. And it's hard enough. You can't let other people put the obstacles in your way, but you can't put them in your way yourself, because people can find a million reasons why they can't do something. But to go out and do it, it's a whole different story. That's why, you know, I'll give anyone credit who starts a movie and finishes it. These are some sort of credit, because that is a monumental task, no matter how you look at it, in the low-budget realm. I can't give everyone credit who shoots a $300 million movie and it's awful. I could do that. My grandmother could do that. Anyone can make a $300 million movie. It's at this grassroots level where you really take what you have despite the odds and you say, okay, we're going to do this. We only have a limited amount of money. We have this camera. It's not the greatest. Oh, well, we're still going to do it, because if we wait to get a better camera or better sound gear or better lighting, it's never going to happen. That's just someone making up an excuse why they can't do it or won't do it.
Considering all the different hats that you have to wear as a filmmaker, is there any one aspect of it that you prefer over the other, like cinematography or acting or directing or producing? Or?
Well, I like directing and editing the best. I like being on the set and taking what you've written. I still find this fascinating to this day, and it might sound weird, but when you think about it, an idea that starts in your head gets transferred to paper, and then you take that and you turn it into moving images with people talking and a plot and special effects, and then you mold that in post-production into a finished story. I really find it all fascinating still. But directing, actually being on the set and blocking the shots and working the actors through it and then editing it, I mean, I think the best directors in the world are probably editors because they can see everything before it happens.
Sure.
You know, they have a sense of putting something together. I mean, a lazy director will shoot one scene from 100 angles because they just don't know what they want.
Right.
An editor knows exactly the timing, the pacing, when to cut to a close-up, when to cut back. You know, you learn all these things. It's just a language that you gather. And I like seeing a movie finished, you know. For better or worse, you know, you made it through that process from concept to screen, and you're involved in every aspect of it. Not just, you don't just show up and run a camera. You know, you were there from the very beginning. You planted the seed. You helped make it grow. You run camera. You run sound. You sometimes have to jump in front of the camera. You work on the effects. It's just the whole process is still to this day really exciting. I can't imagine what it's like on a huge motion picture where you only get to do one thing. I think that would be really boring. I'd probably last a day on a $300 million movie because I'd probably get in trouble by every department for wanting to touch stuff and get my hands in it. And I can't imagine just showing up, barely blocking a scene, calling action, cut, do it again, okay, back to the trailer. That would drive me nuts. To do that for 9 months, I'd go crazy.
Absolutely.
I'd put a mask on and pretend I was an effects guy.
Tell me about some of your earlier influences, inspirations. Who did you like when you were growing up?
Well, it's funny. That's a good question. People ask me that all the time. You know, what made you get into this? And you know, it's a legitimate question that I really don't have a solid answer for. All I know is that one day I was probably 5, and I was watching television, and Godzilla versus the Thing came on, which is, it's called Godzilla versus Mothra now, but when I was a kid, that's what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
He fights the moth and the two caterpillars, and I remember watching that from beginning to end and being absolutely fascinated with what I was watching. And at 5, you don't have a real good grasp on what's real and what isn't, and all I knew is that this is what I want to do. You know, from that point on, you know, I grew up at a good time because a lot of classic movies were on TV. A lot of 70s exploitation movies were on TV. At the theater, you had the big boom of science fiction movies. And then that turned into the 80s where home video came out. So, I was exposed to a lot of different things. Japanese monster movies, Hammer horror, AIP science fiction movies, AIP Poe movies. You know, silent classics like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and The Phantom of the Opera, and just this whole gamut of movies. And then, you know, would buy books that would show you photos, and then these things would turn up on TV because there was no video. And then we got HBO free. I guess I can admit this now, 35 years later. But our neighbor subscribed to HBO, and it it kept bleeding through our cable because the houses were so close together. My parents called several times and said, look, you come and get rid of this because we don't want to get stuck paying for it. And after the third time, the guy that answered the phone, he's like, I don't care. You got it for free. So, you know, I got to see all kinds of things like Food of the Gods and you know, just Squirm and things that you just wouldn't see on television at that time. So there was a whole exposure to a lot of different things. And I'm sure if I looked hard enough, I could find some of that, some of those influences, because a lot of it's subconscious. You just don't realize you're doing it. You know these ideas come from somewhere. And some of them are pretty obvious, like a movie like Forest Primeval that we made is really a love letter to Equinox. It's almost the same movie, a little different, but, you know, that theme is running through it. Among Us is a movie we made, and it's really an ode to a lot of those Sun classic documentaries that you used to see at the theater, you know, about Bigfoot, and, you know, they did everything, pyramids, and I remember the first movie I ever saw in the theater was Chariots of the Gods. Do you remember that movie? My dad took the whole family to see it because he thought it was like a Ben-Hur movie. He was so pissed when it started, and it was like one of these faux documentaries about aliens. He made us all leave. I remember being really angry. That's my first recollection of going to the theater. You know, it's stuff like that you see, and it sticks with you, and I think it comes out, and writers can probably say the same thing, it comes out in one way or another.
Sure.
But we were fortunate to have grown up when we did. Had we grown up a little earlier or a little later, I feel sorry for kids growing up today and the stuff that they have to watch.
Found this on the internet, and I can't really sum up any better than this, so let me paraphrase this. I have a deep appreciation for the Polonia brothers and their films for many reasons, but I can try to boil it down to 2 points. The first is that I truly do enjoy their films, every single one of them. Yes, they're a bit rough around the edges, but with every one of their films, you can see just how much love went into making them. These two brothers are not searching for wealth or fame. These are guys who are saying, let's grab a camera, a script, and a rubber monster mask and see what film we can make next. The second reason is this. As I said, their films may be rough around the edges and inexpensively made, but they're still out there making movies while the rest of us are sitting on our asses trying to get that first film made. And further than that, most people wouldn't have the balls to make another film after some of the ridicule they get for each and every one of their efforts on the internet from all these trolls and what have you. Despite this, they keep putting them out, and they're clearly having fun doing it. Mark, I have to say, I'm really impressed and belatedly inspired by your and John's career, as having just discovered you guys recently. The sheer tenacity and drive, you know, the love of film you have to have held to keep on plugging away year after year, film after film, you know, not worrying about critical response, not worrying about, you know, occasionally getting an imperfect performance or an effect doesn't go the way you want it. Presumably whether or not each film really turns a profit, you know. John McBride had mentioned that feeders cost a whopping $500 to make, and I think he said that his own Wood Chipper Mastermind cost $200. I really wish I had known this and your films back when I was in my early 20s, when I was, you know, studying film and thinking seriously about shooting my own backyard video productions with friends. Everything I'd read from other independent filmmakers, even to this day, as in the Nightmare USA book, which came out recently, mentions difficulties in raising money to produce a picture, difficulties in paying for film processing, lab fees, difficulties recouping costs, losing actual profits to unscrupulous distributors. So this is all very discouraging, and it all held me personally back from seriously pursuing any ideas in this direction. But you and your brother John seem to have sidestepped that entire issue and just made films with basically really no budget, just for the love of it, and then got them distributed anyway. First to video stores, then on DVD through labels like, you know, Brentwood, Tempe, Sub Rosa, Camp Motion Pictures. How did you pull this off? Is it possible for someone starting out these days to produce their own films like you've been able to?
Well, that's a good question. It's like we were talking about earlier. You know, a lot of it just depends on your desire and your love for what you're doing. I mean, you mentioned success. Well, I personally do not see myself as very successful. Someone else may. I look at George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. I see them as successful. It's all relative to where you are.
Right. I mean, if you're talking
where
about
you,
money.
Where you want to go.
Right.
But the bottom line is if it's what you want to do and you really want to do it, you'll find a way to do it. You will not let people stand in your way. That was our motto. Get beside us, get behind us, but do not get in front of us, because this is what we are going to do. There's people out there that don't like it. Good for them. I mean, everyone's entitled to an opinion, and some of their opinions I would have to agree with. Now, you get the opposite end of the spectrum. Well, you know, that people can be overly critical and just cruel, but that's people in general. You got to take it all with a grain of salt. So, you know, you have to have a pretty thick skin to do what we do anyway, because no matter what you do, someone will find fault with it. But you can't even factor that in. Today, I think people have the same opportunities, if not more, because with emerging technologies and YouTube and being able to download stuff on iPhone. You know, it was a struggle when we did it. It was tough. You know, the video industry had started, but by the time we got into it, it was on its way down. We were fortunate. We got into DVD. We made a cable sale. But a lot of it was just because we kept trying. I personally believe some of the best film directors in the world are probably the ones that gave up the race, you know, and that's how you have to look at it. 100 people enter a race, 40 make it past the finish line. Well, did the 40th person come in last? No, he finished. The 60 people that gave up are the ones that should really be numbered, because anyone who starts something and finishes it, in my mind, that's a success. It has nothing to do with how much fame you have, how much money you have. You know, that's inconsequential, in my opinion. It's just you love what you're doing, and you're going to do it because that's what drives you. That's you know, what you want out of life. And so many people in life don't do what they want, or they're afraid to do what they want, or people tell them they can't do it, so they don't. Those kind of things just do not enter into my equation. So a lot of it's a mindset and your desire to want to do something, and ours just happened to be filmmaking.
Yeah, see, because that's what really impresses. It's not the fact that, okay, yeah, you mentioned, like, okay, George Lucas is your ideal success, and you're not there, of course. But the fact that despite any obstacles that you had in your way, you just kind of ignored all the people with their advice, not even just the naysayers and the people that were coming down on you, but people that just, you know, well-meaningly said, oh, geez, you know, you really need to get a distributor. You really need to work up 20 grand for this. You should really put this on film because nobody's going to want to distribute it. All the usual stuff that you hear when you get into this stuff. And you just drove right past that and said, well, you know what? I don't care. I'm going to get out there and do it. And whether you think, you know, you mentioned you weren't sure if you felt successful or not, whether you think that's a success yourself or not, the fact is it's out there. And, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later, there's a couple of people at least out there still talking about these films, still watching them, still enjoying them. And that says a lot, because really, I don't know about other people's definition of life, but to me, life's about two things. One is about interpersonal relationships, and the other one is about creating, you know, expressing your view of the world in various creative modes, and then leaving that to other people to interpret and enjoy, or, you know, do whatever they want to do with it. But you're leaving something behind. You made your footprint. And regardless of whether somebody says, okay, well, you know, actually you could find your stuff in Blockbuster, but, you know, say if you couldn't find the stuff in a Blockbuster, I can't see the stuff on HBO, or, you know, this stuff isn't making $1 million, they didn't really go anywhere, they're still living in the same houses and filming in the same houses with the same repertory cast, some of whom are relatives, some of whom are friends. Despite that, you made a footprint, you know. And, you know, later on I'll give you a chance if you want to speak into something about John. But, you know, okay, yes, he's passed on at a young age, and that's, you know, a sad thing, but he really left a mark, because there are people out there, not just people who knew him, people who worked with him, but people who have never seen the guy before, like me, who just sit there and go, wow, you know, this guy really made his mark on the world, you know, for better or worse, whatever it was, whatever he had to say. It's there, and it's there for, you know, 20 years from now, your kids, your grandkids, if they want to watch this, there it is. And that's
right.
A lot.
I always joke with my kids. It's like, you know, they laugh because, you know, they read some of this stuff. And you know, I think it bothers them. But I'm like, look, you got to get used to this in life. Don't worry about what other people say. But
right.
I always tell them, the day I die, they'll make a $40 million movie about us.
Exactly, like Ed Wood. But, you know, that's the funny thing, is that some of the biggest quote-unquote successes that you're getting for the past, at least since Blair Witch, are things that were stolen from things that were no-budget, Italian and independent, and, you know, these kind of films that were like, oh, you know, the critics are saying these are garbage. You look at a Leonard Maltin guide back when, and it was a bomb. You know, I used to go through the Leonard Maltin guide, and every movie he said was a bomb. I made a point of watching, because 9 times out of 10, they would become one of my favorite movies, whereas the stuff that he gave 5 stars to, I really couldn't give a damn about and still don't. You know, these, like I said, Blair Witch, that's stolen, totally stolen from Cannibal Holocaust, which was
absolutely
one of the most, you know, now it's getting a different critical perspective and a different populist perspective, because people are getting into that now. I guess maybe the threshold is higher after movies like Saw or whatever, so you see something like Cannibal Holocaust and it's not that bad. But on the plus side, you know, these things are getting reevaluated. At the time, these were reviled. This was considered trash. You know, the man was hated. Even when I met him a couple of years ago at Chile, he was kind of on the defensive. You know, like, you know, how do I take this? Am I going to be attacked, or am I going to be liked? You know, what do people like about this? I've been told it's garbage all my life. And yet, these idiots go out and make this really bad imitation of it with some really obnoxious teenagers. There's really no script. It's all shaky cam, and it makes untold money and this huge cultural footprint. So you're exactly right. I mean, this stuff that now is considered, oh, well, you know, this is trash, I don't want to see it. You know, like you said, 10 or 15 years from now, somebody's going to be going, wow, that Tim Ritter film, that was fantastic, or that Mark Polonia film, or that John McBride film, or that, you know, whoever it is. That's going to be the next big Hollywood blockbuster that everybody's going to be talking about, like Avatar. You know, so
as long as I get royalties, that'll be fine.
Exactly. You you can't really focus on that. That's not, at least for me, that's not something I even think about.
Right. Just, well, I thought it was funny when Hostel came out, and I thought, you know, we made this movie 25 years ago. Who is this guy? He thinks he's some wunderkind? Look, pal, we've been doing this a long time.
Exactly.
This is not original. It was just, you know, you were just fortunate enough to get this thing released. But and George Lucas, he's like, well, we're making the first movie on digital. Sorry, George, give me a call. I can set you straight on that one.
What I was going to say originally was the bottom line of all this is, like John had said in the Feeders commentary, and I think it's John McBride that actually said this, you can either sit around watching TV and drinking beer all weekend, or you can go out and make your own movie that we're still here talking about 15 years later. And now it's more like 20-something years. But, you know, that's the point. It's the fact that, you know, you said, the hell with the consequences. I'm just going to raise this up and see who salutes. And, you know, God bless you for that. And I wish
We talked about that earlier, and again, it's, you know, I guess looking back, you know, I don't really reflect on this an awful lot, but looking back, like I said earlier, we just had no concept that we couldn't do it. We just thought, well, everyone else does it, we can too, and we did it. Was it easy? Hell no. I mean, would I recommend it to everybody? If that's what you want to do, yeah. And you know, sometimes there's ups and downs, just like life. Right. There's things I wished, in hindsight, I would have said no to. There's things I wished I said yes to. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is what we've done. This is what we will leave behind. And if anything, I want it to be a testimony to people who don't think they can do something. Well, yeah, well, those guys made a movie. Look how bad it was. We certainly can. And great, if that's what comes of it, that's great, because it's someone else's dream is getting furthered because of something that we've done. That's more than you could ever ask out of anything, to inspire somebody to do something.
Exactly, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, at this age, I wish that I had known this stuff and known about your films back when I was at a younger age and had more contacts and more, you know, the drive to do this. You're still inspiring me in different ways to get out there and just, you know, like I've got a gig coming up. I haven't played a gig in, I don't know, like 15 years. I've got something coming on Friday, and part of it was because of this. It's like, well, you know what? What the hell? You know, Mark's out there doing this stuff. They've been doing this for years. Why am I holding myself back worrying about what somebody might think, whether it's going to go this way, whether it's going to go that way? Who cares? Just get out there and do it. I mean, you know, it's been a long time coming, but it's about time, and I do credit you for inspiring me in that way. I mean, you know, all the shot on video filmmakers, but you and John in particular, not just because you have such a large group of, you know, this large over of films you put out. It's not like John McBride where he put out two, or you guys put out like 30. But beyond that, there's something, well, I'll get to that later, but there's something different about your films that sets them apart from the crop. And like I said, we'll talk about that in a bit. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Thanks for joining us tonight. We have a special re-edit of the Mark Polonia interview tonight. And coming up, we discuss finding yourself and chasing your dreams right here on Third Eye Cinema.
Pioneering the whole shot on video.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, you use the word pioneer, and that's interesting. You know, at the time, we were not aware of that. We were simply just trying to do and create and make a, you know, start our career. And we just did it the best way we could, and that was with a camcorder, because, you know, we used to shoot on Super 8, and that was starting to disappear. It was getting expensive. Super 8 has inherent problems. The image sucks most of the time. You have to redub everything because in their ingenious design of the camera, the motor's right by the sound head, so it always sounds like you're filming next to a jackhammer if you record single system sound. So, you know, I guess we had blinders on. I mean, because we were aware of other filmmakers, and we certainly reached out to them, but it was full steam ahead. We never really thought of it that way. It was just our dream. We were making our dream happen, and that's really kind of what we focused on. And at the same time, you know, we're married, we're raising kids, we have a job. So you factor all this stuff in, and it was daily life for us. When I was a kid, I thought everyone was like me. You know, that's how naive I was. Oh, every kid wants to make movies. And then when you tell them, they look at you like you just flew in from Mars or something. But to me, it was just a way of life. This is how it has to happen, and it will, and it's going to be difficult. But you know what? We're going to make another one. If it doesn't do well, we make another one. And eventually, you know, 25, 30 years later, whatever, you've got a ton of movies under your belt. And you've achieved a little bit of success. So, you know, somewhere along the way, the arrow flew straight. But, you know, I knew other people were doing what we were doing, so I never really saw us as pioneers. I think we were fortunate that some of our titles got picked up by big chains and whatnot. And, you know, some of that's luck. And I'm not going to lie. That's just the way it is. But you know, until you look back, and you may be right. I mean, other people may disagree, and I sometimes don't see it that way. But maybe we did pioneer a generation of filmmakers that, you know, oh, well, these guys can do it, and so can we, and that's great. I mean, if all that ever came of it was that, that's great.
Could you explain to the audience who might not be familiar with the Pony Brothers who you guys are?
Story: we're twins who love making genre pictures, and from the age of 5, that was our dream, and, you know, at age 43, we're still doing it, so something went right.
That's it.
Or wrong, depending on who you talk to.
Okay. My second thing was, tell us about your involvement in film as total auteurist filmmakers, because basically you guys, the way I see it, and I know it's not always the case, but from what I've seen in the credits and the way I see your films and how they seem to have this unifying gestalt, I guess, from concepts to storyboards, scripts to cinematography, you're in front of the camera, you're behind the camera, your stars, your directors. What aspects of this do you prefer?
We did hit on that, and I pretty much love the whole process because every area is fascinating. And the neat thing is just to expound on, is that you're never at a place where you know everything. I work at a university, and I work with young kids and professors who are older, and you learn from everybody. And no one should ever get to a point in life where they say, well, I know everything about this, because they probably don't, and they're not going to really grow and go any farther. So it's just the whole process I always found fascinating, even as a kid, like taking books out of the library and reading about it and writing. You know, I can still remember the first script that John and I ever wrote. It was called The Return of Count Dracula. And I can recite it from top to bottom, but I won't because I want you to keep your high ratings. But, I mean, at the end, Dracula got killed by a mirror. For some reason, he saw himself in the mirror for the first time, and he couldn't stand what he saw, and he disappeared into a puff of smoke. Now, obviously, Dracula can't see him. What's that?
I said, here, I thought you were going to say it was from the garage door opening. Matt, you probably didn't see that movie. So there's a movie called How to Slay a Vampire that Mark and John did pretty early in their careers, and that was the vampire was killed at the end. They opened the garage door and the sunlight came in.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of people think that's a really funny movie. I don't I don't know. It's okay, I suppose.
It's definitely got some very amusing parts. I think the first half didn't work as well as the second half. I don't know, maybe it's because you get punch drunk with all the jokes flying fast and hard. But by the time you get halfway through, it was actually around the time when Marion Cosley came on and did her cameo as the film that you had bought the VHS to see, How to Slay a Vampire.
Yeah, yeah.
Once we got to that point, that's when I started laughing. And it was pretty much straight from there out. What was your inspiration? Who were some of your influences?
We were inspired by so much. And we grew up at such a great time when TV was burgeoning and cable and HBO. And there were still drive-ins and there were still movie theaters that played right. this. I remember seeing Godzilla versus the Smog Monster on television. And a week later, it was at our movie theater. So I got to see it twice because I didn't tell my mother that we'd already
nice.
Seen it. So we got to see a lot of stuff. Even we got all these weird pirate UHF channels, too, that would play
right.
all these movies that I'm sure they didn't have the license to run, but they did anyway. And they'd be on without commercials and, like, Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and then you'd see The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, then you'd see Pit and the Pendulum, and I mean, it just the Flesh Eaters of all things, you know, on and on and on, and
yeah.
we were just exposed to so much, and I don't think without that there would be something lacking, because all that stuff you take in and you store it, you compartmentalize it, and not in a bad way, in a good way.
Right.
I think as you're making a film or writing things, you pull on some of this, because everything you do in life is really an imitation of what you see. There's not you don't really do much original, because
right.
you're a product of what is around you, and to some degree. So, you know, that plays a huge part in what we do. Someone said, like, the difference between Splatter Farm and some of our later stuff is, well, Splatter Farm is a movie we made out of desperation to get make a cult film and get noticed. But I think the stuff we made later is more true to what we are.
Right.
That's more of us in the movies than, say, our earlier stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, I did definitely notice a huge change between maybe your first three or four movies and then everything that came afterwards. It was like all of a sudden something clicked, and then it was you've got the Polonia feel to it. Before that, it was like, okay, you're there. You could tell there's something nice about it. Even in the middle of all that, you know, degradation that's going on in Splatter Farm, there's still something likable there. But it's not to the same extent as when you get to something like Feeders, or when you get to something like Dweller, or, you know, that period.
Right, yeah. It's a process. It's like anything in life. It's a process, and it takes some time to find yourself, I think. Again, as weird as that sounds, on film, you've got to really you feel your way through it. This was okay, but it didn't work. This was a little closer. Let's do this, and suddenly it clicks, and it's like it
opens the door. Especially both of you being so young.
All this stuff starts pouring out.
You know, especially with both you being so young at that point, I mean, you're really just discovering who you are as a person anyway.
You know, we were kids. I mean,
yeah.
Let's face it, we were just like snot-nosed, long-haired kids, you know. That's what we were. We were just kids out of high school, really.
Exactly.
Did I have a girlfriend in high school? I don't even want to answer that question. Probably.
Okay, well, basically, talking about Splatter Farm, you got national distribution on a film you made as teenagers. Admittedly, you were trying to break in, and you were trying to shock, and you know, all the things that were popular at the time, especially on shot on video cinema, but just in general in genre cinema. But how did you pull that off? I mean, that's a big coup, especially
teenagers. That's a fair question, and I think you have to almost go before that, because some people get the notion, I want to make a movie, and they set out to do it. Well, we did that too, but we did that when we were 10. So we had 8 years of failure, discovery, learning something new. You know, we started really doing this when we were just little kids. I mean little, like 10 years old.
Wow.
So we had a head start, and I think that's it. You know, we had covered all that ground and knew from an early age that this is what we want to do, and spent our entire childhood pursuing that. That's something a lot of people don't realize, but
right.
this is what we did all the time. You know, school and eating dinner and having to go to church and going to school, that stuff just got in the way. This is what we... this is what we wanted to do, and that's it. It all boils down to it's just something that you grab a hold of and you just don't let go, because anywhere from 10 or 11 to 18 you could have gotten derailed, you know, with cars
right.
and girls and all the
right.
other stuff.
Right.
But no, we, you know, to our credit, I'm not one to credit myself very much at all, as a matter of fact, but to our credit, we stuck with it. That, I think, is why by the time we were 18, we were in a better position than someone who just decided to do it. Because you have to go through that learning process and
right.
And finding out what works, finding out what doesn't, learning how to place a camera, learning how to light a scene, you know, all those things that, and again it was luck too, that played a little bit, you know, that had something to do with it. But had we not done all the things we had done prior to that, that never would have happened. I mean,
right.
It's amazing when you think about it, everything you've done in life has led you to where you're at.
It's true.
The fact that we're having this conversation, a million things transpired to bring us to this point.
Right.
In your life, mine, and everyone else's. But and that's the way it is. I don't want anyone to give me too much credit because I don't deserve it. I think it was just the fact that we knew what we wanted from a very early age, and we sought to do nothing else, and that put us in a different. On a different path than someone who may see one of our films and think I can do it, and then they go out and try. Well, you have to crawl before you can walk.
Right.
In the beginning, how did you go about learning the actual process, the fundamentals of it? Did you read a lot of books or watch a lot of behind the scenes type stuff, or did you just kind of, was it more of an organic learn by doing thing, or what?
It was a learn by doing. I mean, we had access to a couple books, but it was just, we got a camera and we just started. Let's try this. Some of our real early movies are actually on the Splatter Farm DVD, and I cringe when I look at them. But I mean, That's where we, you know, started. And even before that, we would build monsters out of clay and animate them with stop motion. And we spent a whole summer doing that with a project. But it was just doing, okay, this didn't work. Why? Let's figure it out. Let's try it again. Okay, now this worked. Let's apply this to something bigger. We made shorts on Super 8, but they weren't like most shorts. These had we did a movie called The Night Johnny Came Home. About a guy who comes out of a grave and gets revenge on these people. We did two Halloween night movies. And, I mean, we were out at night in the woods filming with lights, and we had car stunts and people getting thrown through glass. And we tackled these like they were motion pictures. And we set that kind of standard, and that made us – we always reach beyond what we were capable of, because that makes you grow. If we do the same thing over and over and over – you don't go anywhere.
True.
So there was a lot of failure and experimentation, but eventually you start to catch on and learn from your mistakes, and things start to progress. And that's the period, I think, where people tend to just be too hard on themselves and give up and not pursue it. But fortunately, that didn't happen. We had parents who were pretty supportive in the fact that they did not ship us off to a mental institution. To their credit, I mean, they didn't understand what we did, and they still don't or understand the magnitude of what we did, but they never said, you can't do that. Stop, you know, don't do that anymore.
Right.
They never said that. And had they, who knows what would have happened. I mean, if my kids did half the things I did, I'd be pretty upset. Luckily, we just never got caught half the time. But, you know, we'd blow up fake heads in the backyard right under their bedroom window. They never said anything about it. But, yeah, it was just embraced it. You just embraced the whole concept. And you drew people in it who were interested. And some of them stuck around and some didn't. But you move forward, and you know, eventually you gain a momentum that will take you somewhere. You know, where that is, I still don't know, but you can't stop. You have to keep moving forward, and if it doesn't work, you try it again. That's just my motto. I mean, that doesn't work for everybody, but that's the way I have to look at it to stay focused and to not lose that. it's like a childhood naivety. You know, when you're a kid, you believe everything you see and there's no wrong. And as an adult, that gets tarnished. You understand what real life's about, but you can never forget what it's like to be a kid, because you have to have that childlike innocence and sense about you. And I think that's one thing that may be what we never let go of. And for good or bad, I think that's really helped keep us going, especially during, you know, difficult times.
Is it possible for someone starting out these days to produce and have distributed their own films like you've been able to?
I think short answer is absolutely, absolutely.
If I were to come to you on the street and ask you for advice on making my own films and getting them out there today, what tips could you provide to me as a new filmmaker?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd ask you, what kind of films do you want to make? What is your end result? You know, because I do get people that ask me this. Well, I want to make a movie like The Nightmare on Elm Street, and I wanted to make a lot of money. I'm like, well, forget it. You know, if you can make a movie like A Nightmare on Elm Street, but you're not going to make a lot of money.
A lot of money, right, exactly.
You may, and that's great. I said, but I always tell people, you do it because you love to do it, whether it's making movies, surfing, teaching people who can't read to read, you know, whatever, teaching kids to play baseball. If you love what you do, that will take you where you want to go. You know, this is the same with movies. You can do anything you want. There's nothing to say the kid next door won't make a movie that'll play in 3,500 seats theaters across the United States. Because people told us we couldn't do what we did. And I never believed them, because to me it made no sense. How could someone tell me what I can't do? And I tell people, don't give up. Do what your heart tells you to do, and don't let anyone get in your way. There's going to be 1,000 people that will tell you you shouldn't, you can't, don't. I said, stay away from those people, because they're the same people that will do that their whole life, and you don't need that holding you back, because it's a tough business. But if you stick with it, make dramas if you want, make comedies if you want, but do it. Do it over and over and over and over and over again, and eventually that will take you somewhere.
Yeah. I wish I had this advice years ago. It really is. I mean, it sounds simple, but it really is profound. And it's those kind of things that you lose. Like you said, when you get older, it gets crushed out of you. It gets beaten out of you. Life kind of washes it from you. And you just started going around like, well, you know, this is the way it is, and I got to deal with things the way they are. And, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. And I wish I had known that and had that perspective all along. And, you know, to this point where I am right now.
Yeah, and it's my wife's always telling me that. When are you going to grow up? I'm like, I'm never going to grow up. I refuse to, and you can't make me.
it's like Todd said to you in theaters, too. The only thing you have to do is believe.
Yeah, there you go. There's a little Peter Panism in there, and I didn't even know it.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. We're speaking with Mark Polonia of the Polonia Brothers tonight. Coming up next on Finding Yourself, what makes Polonia films different from other shot on video. About your films that sets them apart from the rest of the SOV crop, you know, those 80s shot on video films, like, you know, the stuff that John McBride was doing, the stuff that Tim Ritter was doing, those guys that did Things, you know, all those, that whole genre that was going on at the time. What is it that really makes them stand out? I can answer that, but I want to hear what your answer is.
You know, that's a subjective question. I guess everyone could interpret that different, but I think in our case, it's just a lot of you comes out in a movie, especially when you do it for all the right reasons. You know, we could have made 7 splatter farm movies, but That's all they would have been. But, you know, you get a Feeders, you get a Peter Rottentail, and it's hard to explain, but when you're making a movie, you create an atmosphere on the set. It's either good or it's bad. If it's bad, you get a movie done, but there's a certain vibe to it. But when you're on a set and people are happy and they're getting along and they buy into your dream, they buy into your vision, you make magic happen. And it's something you can't really put your finger on, but you can sense it. You can sense that they were having a good time, and that's what we do when we make a movie. It's too much work to be miserable. You know, life's too short to take seriously. But you know, when you're making a movie, there's a lot going on, but you still have to focus all that and channel all that onto the screen. And I think people have told me this on our sets. They're like, "This is so much fun. I've never had this much fun." And I guess I never really understood it, because it didn't seem like much fun at times. But they see the love that you have, and that's contagious, and it spills over. Like
right.
a teacher teaching kids who really wants to teach kids.
Right.
You know, those kids know that. They know when someone wants to be there with them and teach them. And maybe, and that's a maybe. Maybe that's what people see in our film. That and there's a lot of us in those movies. I mean,
right.
if you watched one of those movies and saw us in it and met us on the street, we're the same person. You know,
right.
there's no facade. We're pretty transparent. That's us. You know, I can look at some of the things I've done and go, "My God," at the time I didn't realize it, but that's really just us being us. Not in splatter farms.
I certainly hope not, especially that barn scene.
Yeah, but later on, it's an infectious thing, and I think maybe that's what it is. I don't know if I could ever answer that honestly or give someone an answer that's satisfactorily, but that's what I get from it.
Yeah, because see, that's what, when we had our conversation earlier before the show, that's what I was thinking. I was like, you know, splatter form, I actually watched it again, and I've come to a much better appreciation of it than I had at the time. I've only seen it once then. But it does fit more in line with the usual shot on video crop, the stuff that VCI was putting out, the stuff like Boarding House, the stuff like Cannibal Campout, something like John Howard's Spine. It's all kind of a piece. There is something different about yours, and it's starting to come out, but it's not quite there yet. But once you get away from maybe 2-3 films in, then it really, like I said before, it really changes. And something about, I don't know, just you and your brother, and then you started bringing in some people that, you know, some actors that you kept reusing, and then you started bringing in people that you knew, like Todd, or you know, your wife came in, and there's more of this, I hate to say, like a family atmosphere, because everybody's going to think Disney, and that's not what this is at all. These are horror films, but yeah, and sci-fi films, all genre stuff, which is what I like. But there's this feeling in there, like you said, where it's just kind of comfortable and homey. You know, most of this stuff, I'll watch this. Like when I put on a slasher film, when I put on a shot on video film, I'll try to do it when my wife's not around, because I know she gets upset with this stuff. She's more sensitive to these kind of things. But I'll tell you that, with the exception of Splatterfall, which I had her kind of watching the other way when I watched the commentary, I basically had her, she actually sat through every one of your films. And for the most part, I think she liked them, which says a lot. I mean, that's really not common for the kind of films that I've been watching lately. Not everything I watch, but, you know, when I'm getting into the kind of grottier end of things, like all the 80s slasher, the shot on video film and these kind of things, there's more of a seedy atmosphere, I guess, to them. And they're more gruesome at times and whatever. Yours really aren't that way once you get past ladder form. And there's something to that. It's something, like you said, about just the way you relate to your brother, the way you relate to your friends, the way that what must be going on the set, maybe your, you know, personal beliefs. I don't know if you're religious or whatever. Maybe just, I don't know, this maybe the fact that you're just shooting around your houses and at friends', you know, backyards and the local forest and using town settings. Like, I know you used that AA pallet supply a couple times. I don't know if somebody worked there. I think you used the supermarket that John might be working in at one point, and saw that in How to Slay a Vampire. I mean, this is your life, your locations, your friends, your family. That all comes through somehow. And it really makes for a different experience. It's the same films, that, you know, maybe one of these other people, John Howard, could have done, but it wouldn't feel the same. There's something different about it, and it really, you know, it makes them special in a way. I mean, some people might not like that, but I think it's a good thing, and it really does show
through. Right. Well, it's so anti-Hollywood because, you know, we're doing the same thing they are, granted at a different level, but we're doing it the way we want to do it. I mean, that's the nice thing. When we have a successful film, that's great. We can congratulate ourselves, but when we make a bomb, we can blame ourselves. You know, we can't point to the six producers who showed up and said, "You're putting my girlfriend in this movie or you're fired." You know, we have a sense of freedom that's good and bad, but nonetheless, we've created this environment that we shoot pictures in that allows us and frees us up to do what we want without much restriction. And I think that helps. Again, that goes back to growing up. You know, we weren't put under a lot of guidelines when it came to this. I mean, there are a few instances where my folks were pretty unhappy with some of the things we did, but, you know, who isn't mad at their kids once in a while? But yeah, you foster this environment, and hopefully people, you know, they catch in on what you want to do and they have fun. You know, if they're having fun, that's great, because a lot of people don't have fun, especially when you think about making a movie. It is a lot of work, and they realize it. But if you keep things in perspective, and you know, you're when you work with people, you know, you tell them you're doing a good job, because they are. You know, you just gotta invite people into it, and maybe, you know, maybe it's part of their dream. You're helping them fulfill something, or you're giving someone a chance that never would have thought they could do something, you know. And then they take that and apply that to something else in their life. Great, you know. You know, this guy thinks I can act. Well, you know what, I'm going to open up my own bait and tackle shop. And they do, and they're successful. Good for them, you know. Everybody wins.
Right.
Everybody wins. So that's the way you have to look at it. It's fun. There's a lot of psychology involved, but it isn't phony psychology. You know, it's you're here because we want you to be here, not because we need you and we're going to exploit you, because we want you to be a part of this. And a lot of people, they latch on to that, and for whatever reason, they catch it too. And, you know, it's just contagious, and I think it shows in on screen. It's like Star Wars. If you look at the original Star Wars and you look at the last one they just made, you'd think two different people made it.
Exactly. It's a completely different vibe.
Because when you watch the original Star Wars, here's a guy who had a dream, and against all odds, he accomplished it. He made it happen, and someone behind him believed in him enough to let that process work. You know, 25, 30 years later, he can pay for everything he wants. It doesn't really matter anymore.
Right.
You can tell. There's a difference between those two movies. Not to take anything away from them, I'm not, but you can tell someone who had a dream and someone who's just riding off of the success of that.
I totally agree. And honestly, that is why a lot of people don't understand why I prefer to watch independents and obscurities from, you know, this country and around the world, for basically from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but, you know, all the way back to the 30s. And then I really won't watch too much stuff from nowadays. I'm not totally oblivious. You know, my wife's into some things. I'll watch things with her. I'll go to the movies. But most of it doesn't affect me at all. I don't care. It's in one ear, out the other. And usually I feel like I would have spent better time, you know, on the toilet. You know, the stuff is actually, it doesn't say anything. I don't feel anything. The vibe is cold. It's like you can tell it was just a board of directors sat there and said, how much profit can we make off this? How fast? What points do we have to hit? What stars do we have to throw in? How much money do we have to throw at it? Done. You know, that's not, there's no value in that. That's just garbage. It's like eating junk
food. It's corporate design. I mean, the at that level, a filmmaker cannot operate with the same autonomy, because he's accountable to getting a release date by June 30th, and we've got to get 3,500 screens, and we've got to make $60 million the opening weekend. That's all that matters, and here's what we think will make it work.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, it's a factory. And you can see directors that started independent and went mainstream most of them, you know, I think they did better work when they were independent. And I think a lot of them probably, they would probably never admit it, but probably wish they could go back and make another $100,000 movie.
And it's very true when you find people like, for example, Wes Craven, or all of the Hong Kong people, when the Hong Kong cinema was a big thing. You brought over people like Choi Hark. You brought over people like John Woo, you know, and Ringo Lam. And all of a sudden, they're making, you know, effectively junk. I mean, yes, I get a kick out of seeing some bad kickboxing movies with, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme or something, but it's not the same thing seeing that as seeing, you know, something like Hard Target? The ones that they used to do back in China with Chow Yun-Fat and Maggie Chung.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a very big difference. Jackie Chan comes over here and he becomes a complete sellout. I mean, you can feel the difference. And, yes, it's the
oh,
same.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're making the same movies. But it's,
one thing that put that point – made that point clear is if you watch the extras on the Hulk that was made, I don't know, 8 years ago, not the
right.
new one, but the older new one, and the director is a Chinese guy. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I know you're talking about Ang Lee.
Ang Lee? Yeah.
Yeah, he's in a meeting and he's explaining to these people around this table, I want four dogs to jump out on the hood and tear it apart and pull her out, and they're like, no, Ang, we can't do that. And he looks heartbroken. He says,
exactly.
Why? And he said, well, that would cost us $20 million. And he just sat there, and I thought, that poor guy has no idea what he just got himself into. Because in his country, they would have said, you got it, and they would have found a way to make it happen.
Exactly.
He would have had
probably on the cheap,
dog
it wouldn't even have the safety
Hulk.
Regulations.
he looked devastated. I thought, oh, that poor guy. He does not understand how this works.
Very true.
Wow.
So, do you think that the move to DTV and film production nowadays has had any effect in recasting these older shot on video productions in a more charitable light? Or is it just that everybody is so sick of the kind of tripe that's being put out now in Hollywood that they're looking back to anything and saying, you know what, these things aren't so bad?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's still good stuff being made, but I think people kind of look back on this stuff because it reminds them of something that maybe once was. I think it's nostalgia. You know, when we were shooting movies on video, it was unheard of unless you were making adult movies.
Right.
Now everyone shoots stuff digitally, which is can still video in my book. They can mask it with whatever word they want, but
and that's
still
part
video.
Of what I was trying to. That's part of what I was trying to get at is because at the time the stigma involved with shot on video wasn't just that you're going outside the system, you're doing this on the cheap, or you know how it might look or not look on tape, but it was that nobody shoots on video except porno producers. So all of a sudden
right.
you were like automatically stigmatized like this.
The only time anything is legitimized is when the big boys do it and take credit for it.
Right, exactly.
I mean, we've done it for years, but it's sneered upon or looked down at. But when, you know, Director A says, I'm shooting this on video because I want to try something different. Well, then all of a sudden they're geniuses.
Right.
You know, they've got to feed their own ego. We don't. You know,
and
we do it out of necessity. They do it because they're bored and they want to do something different, and now they're heralded as geniuses. Which,
right. It's like,
and that goes
right
back.
Right.
What,
and the funny thing is that a lot of successful Hollywood movies are basically big-budget rip-offs of low-budget drive-in movies.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying. We're going right back to that whole business from before about Blair Witch being a rip-off of Cannibal Holocaust. Of, you know, all these things that were done by people in the underground that were, like, looked down on and figured, oh, well, nobody knows about this. I'm just going to steal it. And all of a sudden, because it was put out by somebody in Hollywood and they've got a name attached or they put some budget behind it or played, you know, 500 theaters, now all of a sudden, oh, wow, this is great. This came out of left field. What a great idea. Well, this guy had it 25 years ago. He made fun of him for it, you know. So it's
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. It's strange how all of a sudden – people latch on to this, but, you know, the reality is we're still where we're at, and regardless of what you shoot on. I mean, I met the guys that made Blair Witch, and, you know, good for them. I mean, in all honesty, yes, that movie is probably the most unoriginal thing I've ever witnessed, but good for them. You know, they did something, someone saw value in it, and sadly, it didn't help their careers, but
right.
Same thing with this what was that movie about the ghosts and the paranormal act? You know, good for him. You know, when I watched that movie, part of me was pissed off because I thought, I've done this. right. over and over again. And then I thought, I shouldn't be mad at this guy. And then I thought, you know what, good for him. Good for him that he did something that cost nothing and made more than seven of the big budget Hollywood movies that came out the week before.
Right.
Good for him.
But,
Will I watch the other two? Absolutely not. But good for him. The thing we have to understand is that even though the accessibility for making independent movies has gotten greater, it seems like the amount of people that do it and stick with it is smaller and smaller and smaller.
True.
I guess that was our approach. We'll win by default. Pretty soon there'll be no one left but us. You know,
and that actually kind of happened.
Spider-Man. Who's going to direct Spider-Man 4? Mark and John Polony are the only ones making movies. Call them. I don't know.
Do you think that the easy access to the high definition and internet distribution and stuff is helping or hurting? Or?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, yeah. It gives people an opportunity to put their stuff out anywhere, but you still have to understand the fundamentals of a story. You still have to understand the fundamentals of shooting something so it cuts together. You still have to understand pacing and lighting. You know, there's fundamental basics of filmmaking that you still have to know, regardless of how easy it is to get access to something. So I think it's great that there is that accessibility and that it's easier to make movies now for a 12-year-old than it was when I was 12 years old. But you still, the process is still the same. It's never going to change. And it's almost harder because now everybody's a filmmaker. Everybody has a website that sells movies. Everybody enters their film in competitions and gets awards. So the competition, I think, is greater, but the pool still is shallow, and there's only room for so many people, and that they get weeded out soon enough when they realize that that's not their passion or they just can't stick with it.
The same thing is applicable, because I used to be, well, I still am really, into underground metal back around the same time that you guys were making those movies. I had a band, and I was really into not just the Bon Jovi stuff, but I was more into the really, you know, deep, dark kind of stuff. I was listening to Sepultura in Brazil years before anybody knew who they were. I was listening to all these early death metal bands before they cloned it as death metal. You know, all these strange little things. And what happened at the time was, even though there were so many of these people out, quote-unquote, you're really talking about a pool of, you know, 20 to 40 bands, and that's it. And because those are the only ones that were able to, one way or another, score a deal, get their demo out there. Somebody in A&R said, you know what, these guys deserve a record. And they put it out there, they put the money behind it, such as it was, and got them distributed. Whereas nowadays, you've got literally hundreds of bands that are out there, but most of them, not all of them, I find a lot of good bands, but most of them are junk. And I think that's part of this, almost like an adversity, refining gold in a fire kind of thing, where, okay, we're not just going to take anybody that walks through the door just because they say they are blank. You've got to somehow rise to the crop a little bit. You know, so the cream's going to rise to the top. And it's the same thing that you're saying here as well. Okay, now there might be anybody and their mother can put something out on YouTube, but how many people are really going to sit there and make a movie that somehow gets distributed onto DVD or what have you, streaming, whatever it is, that people will remember, and then they'll go back and do another one and another one and another one, and that's really rare.
Yeah, it's a whole different world. I mean, every decade it's gotten a little more difficult, but there's always a way, you know, no matter what the odds are, there's always a way to make it happen. You just have to see beyond what's in front of you and go, okay, let's try this because no one else is doing it, or, you know, let's do this and show it to such and such. And you never know. There's always a way to beat the system. It's just, you just have to have the tenacity and the foresight to naivety to try it and see what happens.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special reader of the Mark Polony interview. Coming up, we discuss his favorite films and working with John McBride. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema. favorite among your film productions, and if so, why?
A couple stick out in my mind. If I were to pick the top favorite five movies I made, it would probably be Black Mass, which is now called Army of Wolves, which will be coming out on DVD, Feeders, Dweller, The House That Screamed. That was a neat movie to make. That was shot on 16mm. And probably Halloween Night. I mean, you know, they run the gamut from several thousand dollars to a few hundred bucks. But I don't know. Sometimes movies stick out in your mind more than others. I mean, I like them all, or I wouldn't have made them. But looking back, those would be my five favorite for various reasons. Just that one was a challenge that we were able to pull off. When you see Army of Wolves, it's a World War II movie. You know, we got army tanks. We've got the film in this old church. I don't even know how my brother talked the priest into letting us shoot in it. I don't even want to know, but he did. It has scope, you know. It's a really interesting deviation. It looks like something you could put on Sci-Fi Channel, but without all the shitty CGI effects they have. another movie like Dweller. That movie cost $50, literally $50. We shot it over a couple days, and it's a fun little movie. And Feeders was just that movie was so much fun to make. You know, it is what it is. It's pretty bad if you look at it, you know, now, but it was a lot of fun to make, and it shows. And, you know, those things stick with you. Every movie is fun, and there's always good things that happen and funny things you remember and sometimes bad things that happen. Equipment breaks, someone falls and gets hurt, or, you know, the cops show up. You know, those kinds of things every filmmaker deals with at one point or another. But other people like different movies for different reasons. It's hard. It's personal taste, I guess.
Yeah.
So
I mean, because honestly, I would have trouble answering that question myself, having seen as many as I did, because I've seen pretty much everything you have out on DVD at this point, and I'm looking forward to ones like Army of Wolves that aren't out yet. But even so, it's funny because some of the lists that you mentioned were actually among the ones I would have picked. Because I like Dweller a lot, and I like Feeders a lot. And, you know, House That Screamed, I like that one a lot. Halloween Night I liked a lot, but I would have picked Muckman over there. I'm not sure what it is, but there's something about that. And originally I said, you know, maybe it has to do with the fact that Brett Piper's involved. But I had seen a couple of his films recently, and I was like, you know what? I don't think so. It feels more like a Polonia film than it does a Brett Piper film, by far.
Yeah.
And We
both wrote the script for that, and then we cobbled them together. And for some odd reason, he left the funniest part out. I play one of the Gregg brothers, one of those idiots. And my wife said, wow, you're just playing yourself, but with a hat. There was a scene where the girls, they always lag behind because they never, in my mind, and this didn't translate over, but they were always behind because they just never knew what they were doing. But There was a line where the girls walk in front of him. Of course, seeing girls for them is a whole different thing. And then the guys walk in front of them, and they're following. And the one guy says, "Boy, that sure looks good." And then the other Scragg brother says, "Yeah, the girls aren't too bad either." And for some reason, he cut that out. And I said to him, "Brett, why did you cut this out? This is, I thought, legitimately funny." And he's like, "Well, I don't know. It just sounded stupid." I said, "These guys are stupid. People would think that's funny." Maybe not. Maybe it was a good thing he cut it out. But I always bring that up to him when we watch it. I'm like, "Should have left the line in."
Well, I think if it wasn't him, I thought it was him. I've been John McBride. But one of them said, "Yeah, you know," and this is about John. They're saying, "Yeah, you know, his the way he writes, his sense of humor is more like Porky's." So
yeah. Brett said that about me, and that's probably true. But you know, we have to meet in the middle. You can't make a movie about people yapping. I don't. You know, our stories are more visual and action driven than dialogue driven.
Right.
That's just, I like it that way because it's different, you know. Anyone could sit and pontificate around a table or in the front seat of a car. That's why we have Quentin Tarantino. But I prefer to have more action, event driven type of plots than dialogue. Yeah, you need a fair amount of dialogue, but you got to watch out because in low budget movies, see, talk is cheap, and it sure is when some of these people sit down and shoot movies because it just goes on and on and on.
Sure. Here's a question that you sort of already answered again, but here I'll answer it anyway because there are some points to it that you might not have covered. If Hollywood were to come and knock in and hand you a proposal for a big budget production, would you go in that direction, or do you prefer to remain in your more personal, homegrown, grassroots, repertory cast arena production? Because it's a whole different ballgame with a whole different feel and set of rules. In other words, do you, as I suspect, prefer to keep things at a given, more comfortable level where you're essentially in control of the product from inception to finished product?
That's an interesting question. If someone offered me, said, Mark, would you direct this $120 million movie? I'd probably do it once for two reasons. One, for the experience, and two, I'd take all that money and roll it into cheap movies. I mean, I'd go backwards. I'd say, I'll do it. I'll take the money and make a 2,000 cheap movies or set up a studio and let other people do it. I don't think I'd last very long on a big set because my work ethic probably goes against the grain of what happens day to day on that set. I probably would argue with the producers every step of the way. I would probably interfere with every union that's there within 10 minutes.
Right.
And I would probably not be well-liked because I'd say, we're going to work till 3 in the morning. Don't bring chairs because unless you see me sitting, you're not sitting. And that would be the end of it. I've been on movie sets, and it's tense, it's stressful. People are there for the wrong reasons.
Right.
They're making product on a film that we do. There's a totality where you're part of everything, and everyone's part of everything. And that's important too, where people have a say in what they're doing.
Right, and that's what I was also thinking was. You lose that total control. Not to sound like this is some kind of Machiavellian thing, which it isn't from the perspective I'm seeing. Anyway, I haven't been on one of your sets yet, but having seen these things, that's not the impression I get. But you come in right now. You're writing. You're producing. You're creating. You're lighting. You're everything, and you've got your people all in, like you said, working on every aspect of production. And all of a sudden, you walk into something like Hollywood, and the whole thing is taken away from you. It's like shut up and just work the camera. Yeah. And that's a very different, I couldn't picture you guys working at something like that. I couldn't picture working at something like that.
I don't think I could. I mean, I like being able to say to the guy doing the lights, hey, what do you think about this idea? Or what would you do? You can't do that on a big set. And you're always up against the wall, and it's not the same. It is not the same. You even hear in interviews these big directors, they say, I wish I could go make another $300,000 movie. And I think, why can't they?
Right. And the funny thing is, like you're saying, about how you want to have everybody's opinions and what do you think about this? What should we do here? That's actually the way I hear that all the Italian films were run, all these Italian genre films that I love so much. It's, when you get on one of those sets, it doesn't matter that you're just the guy holding the grip or, whatever it is, some guy bring coffee, they're going to have a problem and say, oh, well, what do you think? How should we film this? You got any ideas? How do we get past this special effects problem? Which is another thing we've lost with Hollywood because of the CGI thing, is nobody's sitting there being creative like a Mario Bava where, okay, how do we change this 4-foot square room around to make it look like a castle? Because they just say, just give it to, Industrial Lights and Magic, they'll do it.
Right. It's a team effort. I mean, it really is a team effort, and you value everybody, and on top of that, you value their opinion. I mean, if someone says, "Look, I don't think my character would do this," I'd say, "Okay, why not? It can convince me why." And if they have a legitimate reason, I'll be like, "You know what? You're absolutely right. Let's do it your way, or let's do it both ways." And you can look no farther than the movie Grindhouse. Here's a $60 million movie that was made to look like a $300,000 movie.
And it doesn't even
work. $100,000 and say, okay, go make a Grindhouse movie. Don't make a big budget movie and then make it look like a low budget movie. They missed the boat on that. The best thing about that movie were the trailers.
Well, strangely enough, I actually did like Death Proof because it reminded me of something like Switchblade Sisters or that kind of line, like a Jack Hill production. But nonetheless, it's still, you can tell it's contrived. You can tell that they sat there, oh, let me put a fake film splice here.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put some fake, you know, degradation of the film stock here. It's not quite right. And I actually liked that one better than the other one because there was less plot. Like, so it became more of, okay, let's just see what he's doing, how he's going to make it look like it's a real grindhouse picture, which a real grindhouse picture, like you said, probably costs, you know, $1,000, $5,000. You know, this guy's spending how many millions of dollars on this thing? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was a fortune. And, you know, they could have done – I bet you they'd have made a better movie if they'd have just went and get – you know, each took $150,000 and went out and did it. I'm sure – you know, maybe they can't do that anymore. That's the other thing I wonder. When you get to that level, I think they forget – people forget where they started, and they just think, well, I can't go do that again. I just can't do that again. I think that's it. They don't want to do it again.
And
they're
again,
at a comfort level where that's just not something they're interested in doing.
That's another parallel with the music thing I was talking about before because – again, a lot of the bands that I was listening to, they would actually have, like, the guitarist would say, you know what, let's have the drummer come in and make some guitar riffs because they wanted some kind of naivete to come in where, you know, I'm so used to doing this way and I want this production, I'm used to playing this style, let's dumb this down. And then you have bands like Dark Throne where they come in and say, you know what, I don't want a nice microphone to record this. Give me the crappiest, most beat-up microphone you got. And they have to pull out something that's like, you know, used to sticking into one of your little tape recorders or something. And it's all scratched up. You know, the head's popped open and everything else. The speaker's got a hole in it. And then it's like, yeah, that's the sound I want. And everybody's sitting there looking. I'm like, what are you doing? But that's what it is. You're trying to recapture that naivete that gives you this kind of spark. It's also why most bands, to my taste and some other people I've talked to, you really don't feel that they have anything going for them past their first album or two. It's like that teenage, I don't know what it is, drive, where it's like, I can do this, and I don't really know what I'm doing. And it makes something much better than later on when they can play better, but they have nothing to say.
Right, right. Well, I think you're out of the area where you're problem solving and you're out of the area where it's a challenge anymore because when you're on a gigantic budget picture, you don't have those problems. Oh, you know, we've got a problem here. We needed three more windows in this set. Okay, we'll break for a day, go build them. You know, you just throw money at it. That's
mm-hmm.
the solution. There's no, you know, we've got an hour to figure out how to do this because we're, you know, we're wasting money. Those things you draw upon to get you through, that strategy solving, it's not there. That's not
right.
a problem. And I think that's what keeps people sharp, you know. I think when you have all this at your disposal, I don't think that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make a better movie.
Right.
I'm not sure if someone gave me $100 million, I could still make a really good movie. I could make something, but who knows what it would be. It'd probably be far removed from what people are used to seeing.
Well, I think that's what John, your brother, had said at one point. I'm pretty sure it was him on one of the commentaries. Because if you threw some kind of like $1 million budget at me, I'd probably still make a Polonia Brothers film. It just might look a little nicer, you know.
That's right. And you know what? He's absolutely right. That's why not? You know, that's if someone was going to give us that much money, you know, they better let us run with it because it's not going to happen again. Guys, I forgot to wish you a happy Halloween.
Oh, happy Halloween!
Yes, thank you. Happy Halloween.
We had trick or treat here on Saturday. And it was, I thought, you know, I was driving through town. I was actually taking Brett Piper home. We were doing some pre-production work. And I thought, why are all these kids dressed as ghosts? There's no original costumes. And I realized they were covered with snow. It was snowing so hard here. I'm like, that makes perfect sense now. I thought, what's everyone a ghost this Halloween?
So let's change gears a little bit here, and I want to talk about some of the people that you've been working with, just vaguely here. Tell me about how you hooked up with John McBride, and if you could, try to explain to the audience who he was before he got hooked up with you guys.
John McBride, it was as simple as, do you remember Leif Yonker, the guy that made Darkness?
No, that's not...
Super 8 vampire movie. He had contact with John McBride, and I, you know, I would talk to Leif off and on about different things, distribution and technical things. We'd bounce back and forth, and he said, oh, yeah, I talked to the guy that made Cannibal Campout, and I immediately, and I knew who it was because I'd seen both of his movies, and I said, well, you know, do you mind if I ask for his phone number? He's like, no, not at all, and because the same company released Splatter Farm that released Cannibal Campout, so at the least we could exchange how badly we got screwed. I called him up, and we were. It was like we'd known each other our whole lives. You know, we talked a few times. I think at first he was a little suspicious, but he knew, he had a vague idea of who I was. But we just kept in touch, and then he came up. We visited me for a weekend, and we just sat around and watched movies, talked about movies, and we thought, you know, let's make a movie. And theaters became that. And he was the funny thing is and again, you that goes back to what we're talking about, pioneers. And this is why I don't really see ourselves much as that, because the exact same time we were shooting Splatter Farm, he was shooting Cannibal Camp Out. Exactly, almost to the month.
Yeah.
That's weird. And, you know, our paths happened to cross, and, you know, we're still good friends. We don't see each other as much as we used to. And, you know, he lives out west and travels to California, but we don't work together as much, but we still stay in contact with one another. And he's a great guy. Again, you know, you watch Cannibal Camp Out and you think, God, this guy's demented, but he's just like us. I mean, it's almost like he would have been a brother, another person in our family that shares the same type of desires and interests, and he's just a plain good guy. I mean, I'm glad I met him. I have a lot of good friends. He's one of them. And it all started with a phone call.
Yeah, see, because it's funny, because I actually found John's stuff first. And I had the exact same experience, because starting off with Cannibal Camp Out was like starting off with you guys with Splatter Farm, which I did. And I was kind of put off by it, because it was so, you know, gruesome and whatever. But at the same time, there was something about it that was really likable. And I was like, you know what, I like this guy. I like a lot of this cast, but something about it is just really repelling me. But then I saw Wood Chipper Massacre, which he said he made for like $200, and I really liked that. You know, and I was like, okay, this is what this guy was trying to go for. It's just, you know, he was going for that, you know, typical shot on video, let's put all the gore in thing. And that's the one everybody remembers. Nobody remembers Wood Chipper, really. They always go for Cannibal Camp Out. There's even a song about it, which I like a lot, from a band called the Vladimirs. But it was the same kind of thing, and I got the same vibe. And then when I started seeing your films, I was like, you know what? These guys are a lot like John McBride. And all of a sudden, bam, there you are doing movies with him. I was like, wow, this is strange. And I saw that thing from the Bryce Kennedy Show where you guys were on it together, you know, miming to one of his songs. I'm like, well, how did this happen?
Oh yeah, it's a match made in hell, I suppose. But, you know, we're fortunate. I mean, you know, the people that work with us deserve just as much credit, because without them, without their contribution, what we do would be less of what it is. And I never want to minimize the extra work and work that other people put into it, because they deserve just as much credit as us. We may have spearheaded it, but they helped, and they, you know, our actors, our you know, technicians, people that do the music for us, my wife who cooks and lets us shoot in the house. You know, without them, we would not be able to do it. So I you know, they deserve as much credit as anybody.
And that's another thing that sets you guys apart, is that you're willing to give that credit, and you could see it, because it's not just, okay, I like the two brothers. It's, well, I like the two brothers. I like John McBride. I like Bob Dennis. I like Dave Fife. I like, you know, and you keep seeing these people over and over again. I like Todd Carpenter, you know, and it becomes like this family. You know, okay, yeah, you're watching some video, you don't know these people from Adam. But there's a kind of a feel there where it's like you always kind of know what you're going to get into. You know who's going to be there, more or less. And it's almost like a Hitchcock. I'm like, oh, when's he going to show up? You know, what's his part going to be? And sometimes you don't even know, or you have to go on IMDb. They don't even list them being there. But all of a sudden, pop, there it is for a couple seconds. You've got a cameo with Todd Carpenter. You've got a cameo with your wife. You've got a cameo with whoever it is, you know, Dave Fife. And that really kind of sets things apart again. From the usual directors that's going to sit there and say, oh, well, I did this and I did that, and it was my vision and my this and my that. Yours really feels more like a group effort.
Yeah, and it is. And you know, someone has to take responsibility or blame ultimately, and that would be John and I, and sometimes John McBride, because, you know, we've got to keep it on track, keep it focused, but you still have to keep it open enough that people can contribute, because then they've invested something in it. They have a vested interest in it, and that's the way it should be, because then they feel like they're contributing, and they are. I mean, some really good ideas just came from people who were standing and said, hey, you know, what do you think of this? Oh, that's a great idea. We'll use it. And, you know, that helps create that environment, and people like that because they right. want to be a part of something that feels good
and they're valued
and that they have some say in, and they're important. Right. They're just as important as the rest of us.
Just quickly, again, the same kind of question. Tell us about how you got together with Brett Piper, and again, you know, who he was before he got involved with you guys.
Yeah, Brett. Brett actually had a lot of success. His budgets have always been, you know, much, much bigger. We joke about Muckman. He says Muckman's the cheapest movie I ever made. I said, Brett, it's the third most expensive film I've ever made. So we kind of meet in the middle. But I met Brett because he was looking for an editor to help him finish Drainiac because he had signed it to some guy and the guy couldn't help finish it. And I knew him. I said, well, give me his number. I'll call him. So I called him up and, we got Drainiac finished. And he went and then was able to get a deal with it. And we worked together. I help him. He helps me. So he's a good guy, talented. Extremely talented. Here's a guy that could have made Star Wars by himself. He literally could like have an effects shop in Hollywood and probably be a millionaire, but he likes doing what he does. He likes being independent. He's got the same mindset.
Right.
He works a little bit on the upper scale because he was able to get better deals and more money. But with that came a lot more problems than what we've had. I remember him saying, he's like, he was frustrated about a film he had just been on and said, God, I wish I could just do what Mark and John Poloni do and just go make a movie. The hell with all this bullshit. And I thought, and well, here we are. You know, we made Muck Man. So, you know, everybody at every level probably wants something different, but
right.
You know, you got to be grateful for what you have and you just make it work.
Okay. Did you and John both meet your future spouses on set, or you already know them and then convince them to get involved in your films? And if that, then how difficult was it to convince them to get in front of the cameras?
How difficult was it to be in front of the camera versus behind the camera?
Well, no, I mean, if you didn't meet your spouses on set, if you actually dragged them in and said, you know what, I want you to be in our films, how difficult was it to get them there? You know, did they put a big fight like, oh, God, I don't want to do this?
Sometimes it was difficult. You know, my wife doesn't like to be on camera, but, you know, they win by default. So as good sports, they do it. But, you know, it's like anything else. They're willing to give it a try for the sake of the team. Sometimes they get tackled and they're on the bench for the rest of the season, but, you know, they'll try it once.
No, because I just know how hard it is to get my wife to even pose for pictures, so I couldn't even picture. You know what? I want you to be in this movie, so I figured it brought its own special problems. Tell us about your son and his budding film career.
Well, my son, you know, my daughter has zero interest in what the filmmaking side. Much like my wife, who's, you know, bless her, is tolerant of what I do. My son is much more like me. He really does have an interest in filmmaking. He's more creative. He was sitting here the other day in front of this computer, and he showed me a picture. I said, where'd you get that photo? And it was of these giant rock and the snowscape. And he said, well, I made these rocks out of clay and painted them, and I went into the computer and I put this background in. I thought, holy crap, it looks like, you know, something off of Lord of the Rings. And it really looked great. And, you know, he's fortunate because, you know, my dad had zero interest in filmmaking. And I always tell him, I said, you know, you're lucky because you're exposed to all this. I mean, this kid grew up on a film set. That's all. He grew up doing what I wish my dad did. You know, I thought, how cool would that be? So who knows where he'll take it. Hopefully he can parlay that into, you know, a career of some sort. You know, you have to temper your dream with a little reality,
right.
And bills
sure,
have to get
sure.
paid. But somehow you can manage to meld the two. And he's, you know, for his age, he's a lot farther than I was. But he didn't have, you know, he learns by example. He can watch me make all the mistakes and go, God, I'll never do that. You know, we had no one to do that. So he's a big help.
I think it's on the extra for Splatter Beach, you actually have a short of his with Dave Fife in it. And I was watching it, and I was like, I actually almost thought it was one of yours. And I'm like, no way, this is his son doing this. And it's actually, you know, especially for his age.
It's funny you
say
that, because there's a review on YouTube, someone posted it, and he goes, wow, his son managed to do something his dad couldn't, make a watchable movie. I showed it to Anthony. I said, Anthony, read this. You'll get a kick out of it. And I thought, you know what? He felt good. You know, he didn't feel good that someone was, you know, taking a jab at me, but that wasn't the point. The point was, you know, someone said what you did was good, and you need, no matter how it was used, you need to take that and appreciate it. He did. He did most of that himself. I guided him a little bit, but most of that was him. He sat down in front of the Avid, and I showed him how to digitize it. I helped him write it. I showed him how to, you know, storyboard it. Here's what I would do. Where do you want to put the music? Good. That's a good place for it. No, don't put it there. Here's why. And you know, a lot of it's his vision. I'm not going to tell him what to do because he still has to learn, but, you know, it was a fun process.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the discussion tonight with Mark Polonia. In 2 weeks, on week 17 of Third Eye Cinema, Cynthia Rothrock. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com. Or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema, plus you by the Big Papa Online button, or talk to you. Or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Block Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.